This is The Takeaway for Tuesday, July 18th, 2017.
This is The Takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick, filling in for John Hockenberry. Thank you so much for listening. The Better Care Act is dead. Republican leader Mitch McConnell's second attempt to repeal and replace Obamacare and make good on a seven-year Republican promise suffered a fatal blow last night. This time, it was conservatives who delivered the final swing. Senator Mike Lee of Utah and Jerry Moran of Kansas together said they won't support the repeal and replace plan because it doesn't go far enough in repealing Obamacare. There were other senators against it too, conservatives and moderates publicly and privately, and in the end, all you need to know is that Mitch McConnell doesn't have 50 votes from his own Republicans. This morning, McConnell said his next play would be to try to repeal Obamacare even without a replacement to go along with it. But even that plan appears to lack the votes now, as a number of Republican senators have come out against it. President Trump says he thinks the time has come to do nothing, let the Affordable Care Act collapse. Here he is today talking to reporters in the White House.
We've had a lot of victories, but we haven't had a victory on health care. We're disappointed. I am very disappointed because, again, even as a civilian, for 7 years I've been hearing about health care, and I've been hearing about repeal and replace. And Obamacare is a total disaster. Some states had over a 200% increase, a 200% increase in their premiums. And their deductibles are through the roof. It's an absolute disaster. And I think you'll also agree that I've been saying for a long time, let Obamacare fail, and then everybody's going to have to come together and fix it and come up with a new plan, and a plan that's really good for the people with much lower premiums, much lower costs, and much better protection.
Jeffrey Young covers healthcare for HuffPost, and he joins me now in the studio. Jeff, welcome back.
Hi, Todd.
What happened last night? Mike Lee and Jerry Moran came out against the bill, but they weren't alone.
No, I mean, so that made a total of four Republican senators who were publicly opposed to voting to move this thing forward. Three of them from the conservative side, and as you mentioned about Moran and Lee, that it didn't undo enough of the Affordable Care Act. And the fourth was Susan Collins from Maine, who more or less talked about, you know, all the many millions of people who would have lost their insurance if they had made this thing law. There were other Republicans like Dean Heller from Nevada and Lisa Murkowski from Alaska who said similar things to what Collins said, but they never actually came out and said they'd vote against it. It's possibly revealing that the objections to this bill that sank it weren't about the 22 million people who might lose insurance or the higher deductibles or people with pre-existing conditions maybe being frozen out of the market again. It was that those things didn't happen enough.
For a lot of senators.
For a lot of senators.
But Jeff, let's step back from the votes and what's going to be on the Senate floor for a minute, because this is a remarkable Republican moment. I mentioned in the intro there for how long Republicans have been promising to repeal Obamacare. They've really made it the center of their political existence for the last 7 years. And we're in a moment now, it seems, where clearly they can't put it together. But even this latest version of the bill was trying to do some very un-Republican things. They were leaving big tax increases in place to try to get votes. They were spending more money on people's insurance costs, not a very conservative thing to do. And it still wasn't enough to get them over the line. What's going on with Republicans now?
Well, I mean, stepping back even further from that, if I may, I mean, fundamentally, what's always seemed missing to me from this whole internal debate among Republicans about what to do on healthcare. And by the way, I mean, that what to do on healthcare doesn't just mean what to do about the Affordable Care Act and how much to repeal it and when to repeal it and how many bad words to use to describe it. It's completely unclear looking at the bill that the House passed in May and that the Senate gave up on Monday and divine exactly what the vision is, right? I mean, you know, if you look at the Democratic Party, you've got a range of people from single payer, which is to say everyone's covered and the government finances it, or something that looks like Obamacare, where not everyone's covered and the government pays for some people to get help and not everyone. But the goals are pretty clear. You know, the idea is maximize the number of people with health coverage so they have access to health care and, you know, protect them against really high costs when they get sick. I don't know that I've really heard, you know, anyone from the president to Mitch McConnell to Paul Ryan and down the line actually articulate what their ideal healthcare system looks like, other than just to say things along the lines of, not to be glib, but, you know, well, the market will figure it out. And I think those of us who've used the American healthcare system have reason to doubt that the market can figure it out.
And also that they're on a rescue mission from Obamacare, which is more popular than it ever was when Barack Obama was president. Well, Jeff, before we let you go, you mentioned a little bit about Mitch McConnell's next move. He says, we're going to vote on full repeal, senators. This is your chance to show that you're really for repeal of Obamacare. Does this strategy work? What's he up to and what's he trying to do?
I mean, I feel like where else is he going to go from here? As people have heard, there have been dozens of votes like this over the last 7 years in Congress, and this could just be another one of those that's really more symbolic than anything else, because it might not even pass the Senate, you know, but those who want to say they voted against it can say they voted against it. I'm not sure what they then tell their voters to whom they've been promising all this time, not only that they would get rid of this horrible Obamacare thing, but also that the key to it is we need total control of Congress. We need the House, we need the Senate, and we need the presidency on top of that in order to execute our agenda. And here they are with all of those things, and they can't execute their agenda. And, if I voted for Obamacare repeal, I'd be pretty disappointed right now.
It's a different Senate than it was 2 and 4 years ago, and the Affordable Care Act is in a different political position than it was. Jeff Young with HuffPost. Thanks a lot, Jeff.
My pleasure.
Here at the White House, we are dedicating the month of July to three of our favorite words, Made in America.
This is Made in America Week.
Emphasizing American workers and manufacturing.
Made in America will make America great again.
Hi, I'm trying to find out if a certain coffee maker was made in the USA.
What's made in America?
Budweiser is based in Belgium. Burger King is based in Canada.
American beef is now being shipped to China for the first time in 13 years.
Now, where were these made?
These were made, I don't know where they were made, but they were made someplace, but they're great.
Well, the implosion of the latest Senate healthcare bill is blotting out another banner week at the White House. Infrastructure Week came and went, so did Energy Week, both largely occluded by scandal and investigations. Well, now it's Made in America Week. Here's the president.
We want to build, create, and grow more products in our country using American labor, American goods, and American grit. When we purchase products made in the USA, the profits stay here, the revenue stays here, and the jobs, maybe most importantly of all, they stay right here in the USA.
So the president on the White House lawn yesterday, he showcased Wisconsin-made fire trucks from Pierce Manufacturing. There was farm equipment from Caterpillar, and even the president from Queens, New York, trying on a Stetson cowboy hat from Texas. But slogans aside, can the president's vision of a return of American production ever be a reality? David Otter is Ford professor and associate head of the MIT Department of Economics. Professor, welcome.
Thank you very much. Good to be here.
Well, let's start with President Trump as an example, because he's an American businessman and his family's in American business. He likes to promote American manufacturing. Of course, a lot gets made of the fact that his daughter Ivanka's apparel line gets made in China. If you go to Trump hotels, you'll find shower caps and toiletries made overseas. These are just two small examples, but knowing what you know about the state of American manufacturing, does any of that surprise you?
The state of American manufacturing is somewhat precarious, and it is still the case that the U.S. is the world's second largest manufacturing economy in terms of value added. But manufacturing employment has fallen by more than a third since the year 2000. So it is not we would not say it's a thriving time for U.S. manufacturing. I think it's also worth pointing out, by the way, that one of the claims that the president made in the remarks you played is incorrect. If you buy in America for products made in America, that doesn't necessarily mean the profits reside in America. There's a lot of foreign-owned manufacturing in the United States, most prominently in motor vehicles.
Toyota plants in Tennessee and throughout the South. for example.
Of course. Yeah, Toyota, BMW, Volkswagen. And that's a good thing. But I'm just making the point that the fact that something is made here doesn't mean that the profits end up here, because there's a lot of foreign direct investment in the United States. Again, something we should welcome. We just shouldn't oversimplify.
So I made an example of President Trump, the businessman, and Ivanka Trump, not to single them out specifically, but as two big-time American business people who would like to promote American manufacturing, but still find themselves purchasing products overseas. There's a dilemma there.
Of course, we're going to be purchasing products overseas, and it's silly to think otherwise. The question is whether the American manufacturing infrastructure can remain vital, innovative, profitable, and produce leading products. We do not want to return to a time when, you know, most of our shoes are made in America, and our clothing and our toys and assembled things. Those are labor intensive goods. They have low value added. It would be expensive and inefficient to make them here. We are in general wealthier for having other people make them, and we exchange that for other goods that we make. What is very important is that the U.S. maintain innovative leadership in high technology products, things, you know, steel and automotive and electronics and machine parts, aircraft. That's where, as a highly educated, a highly skilled and technologically advanced country, we should have comparative advantage. And we should be concerned about losing our lead there. And I think that's very much at risk. But being concerned about that is not the same as being concerned about the fact that implements at Trump hotels are made in China. That's kind of irrelevant.
And irrelevant primarily because you say we shouldn't be concerned about these low-end products. We don't want to be manufacturing them here.
Of course not. No, that's not, you know, there's a reason that most of the clothing that you are wearing was, you know, made either in India or Bangladesh or Cambodia. Those are countries that are labor abundant and the cost of labor are low. Those goods require a lot of time and care to produce. And if they were made in this country, they would be a great deal more expensive, and we would all be somewhat poorer for that. And those poor countries would also be poorer because they would lose a vital source of employment and foreign investment. Trade in general makes the world wealthier. We don't want to be, if we were a closed economy and everything we made were things that we produced here, we would be significantly poorer.
Well, Professor, we're going to talk about steel in just a minute. And I wanted to ask you about it. Is there anything the president really can do from his office to bring back U.S. steel?
Well, you can certainly impose tariffs on foreign steel producers, as the U.S. has done on many occasions. There are a couple of risks to doing that. One is, of course, it invites retaliation. The other is, you know, the U.S. is a relatively small steel producer and a big steel importer. And so there are many, many other industries that use that imported steel. And if you impose tariffs, you will be raising prices on those industries. So the automotive industry, the, you know, construction industry. So you could help the steel industry directly by reducing import competition through tariffs, but you wouldn't be helping the U.S. economy in aggregate. So there's no simple way to do this. But on the other hand, I do agree that there is such thing as unfair dumping, where a country subsidizes its producers until all the foreign competition goes out of business. But there's no simple lever you can flip that makes everybody better off than the United States.
David Otter, Ford professor and associate head of the MIT Department of Economics. Thank you.
Thanks very much.
So you heard David Otter talking about steel there. In April, the president asked Commerce Secretary Wilbur Ross to review the steel industry and consider new tariffs on imported steel. Ross's findings are expected to be released soon, but even the idea of tariffs has a lot of Republicans cringing. There are about 150,000 steel workers in America now, according to the Commerce Department, but industries that use steel employ many, many times more. So if the Trump administration does go for tariffs, they won't just impact U.S. steel industry, they'll also affect U.S. manufacturers that rely on that cheaper imported steel. And the real question is, would it help bring back jobs to the U.S.?
We make things like storage cabinets and bookcases, shelving, lockers, all sorts of different types of racking and light-duty rack. Different types of filing cabinets, open-shelf filing. It could be card files. It could be literature sorters. Full gamut.
That's Stuart Spire, the president of Tensco Corporation, a manufacturing company in Tennessee. And I spoke with him earlier about why buying American is such a challenge.
Well, we compete in a global marketplace, and so we have to have competitively priced steel to compete. And unfortunately, U.S. steel is higher priced than most anywhere else in the world, and that does present real challenges.
So what does that mean for you? I mean, I know you're a patriot. You know, you'd love to buy U.S. steel all the time. How do you calculate what to use?
Well, some products where 50% or more of our cost is just the raw steel. So if we're paying a lot more for steel, it certainly hurts us. We compete against, for example, Chinese manufacturers of lockers and cabinets and bookcases and workbenches. And we're paying 60 to 80% more for our raw steel than those same Chinese competitors. And that presents a real challenge.
I mean, that's the challenge, isn't it, in a global marketplace?
Exactly. I mean, there are other factors. I mean, certainly in the U.S., our wages are higher. Our benefit costs like health insurance are higher. But the biggest thing right now for us is the price of steel.
So, Stuart Speier, if the Trump administration went for tariffs on Chinese steel to discourage it in the U.S. market, what impact would that have on you and your business? Do you think it's a good idea?
Well, obviously, I don't think it's a good idea because we already pay more for steel. And the obvious goal of the tariffs would be to increase the price of steel to help support domestic steel producers. But that just puts us behind the eight ball. There's lots of protection for steel already in place, but there's nothing really preventing finished goods from coming into the United States. And as a result, instead of them shipping coils of steel from China or Japan or wherever, you're seeing finished products. And that's the challenge.
So there are proposals out there to tax those finished products at the same rate that they tax your products. It sounds like that's something you would like to see, a value-added tax.
Well, that would be certainly help us a lot. If you're going to tax the steel, you've got to think about the downstream consumers of steel like us. But I mean, we're just one example. There's tens of thousands of other metal benders out there who are consuming steel. And if you don't think of them, ultimately, who are your customers going to be if they're losing their business and going out of business?
Right. So, Stuart Speier, you've got one of these downstream companies. And if America went to war with Chinese steel, let's not beat around the bush. What would it do to jobs at your plant?
Well, obviously, as we're losing business, and we are losing business now, we will have to adapt, which means probably laying off people and trying to react in whatever way we can.
So as you watch these debates that are going on, Stuart Speier, you're a business owner, you use lots of steel downstream. Made in America and U.S. steel isn't an academic argument to you. What should happen?
Well, I'm hoping, and there's some very smart people out there looking at this problem, particularly at the Commerce Department, that they look at the broader picture. On face value, it seems, oh, well, this is simple. The steel industry is hurting. They're facing tough foreign competition, so let's just limit that competition and help out the steel industry. But you've got to think of the consequences of that. There is many times the Wall Street Journal estimated 60 jobs downstream for every job in the steel industry. So you may temporarily solve an issue for the steel industry, but at the cost of losing a whole lot more jobs, manufacturers like us and any industry that uses steel is going to be hurt by this.
Stuart Speier, president of Tensco in Tennessee, thank you so much for being with us.
I appreciate you having me.
And we're asking you at 877-8-MY-TAKE, is it important to you to buy American? Do you find it hard to buy products made in the United States?
My name is Stephanie Hansford, and I'm calling from Titusville, Florida. Buying American, quote unquote, isn't my priority. Trying to buy quality at a fair price takes precedence. If that quality is American-made as it should be, I'll buy it. If it's German, Italian, Korean, or Chinese, that it's well-made and it does what I need it to do, I'll buy it. Being American doesn't stop us from making shoddy merchandise.
This is George calling from Salem, Massachusetts. I prefer to pay a little more for better quality. Many higher quality products are made in the USA, so it feels good to buy local.
Buying American in the USA. More coming up here on The Takeaway. Sports franchises tend to stay far away from controversial political issues, but not the Seattle Storm. Tonight, the Storm of the WNBA is holding a rally for Planned Parenthood before their game against the Chicago Sky. The Seattle Storm is also donating a portion of ticket sales to Planned Parenthood for the Greater Northwest and Hawaii. The rally came from the team's owner herself, and that's something you don't see in other pro sports. It's one thing that sets the WNBA apart. Dave Zirin is sports editor for The Nation magazine and host of the Edge of Sports podcast, and we talked about why tonight's rally is worth noting.
This is one of the unique things about the Seattle Storm. First of all, they're one of the few teams in all of professional sports in the United States that is owned by a woman. Her name is Dawn Trudeau. And what she has spoken about is her own frustration about feeling like her inability to impact this debate that we're having about healthcare and the demonization of Planned Parenthood, a demonization that persists even though, according to polls, it's far more popular than, say, the president or the Republican Congress. And so what Dawn Trudeau decided to do was say, I want to use my team as a vehicle to promote Planned Parenthood and what it actually does, not what its detractors say it does. And the response has been amazing. I certainly think it helps that she's in the ecosystem of Seattle where Planned Parenthood is very popular. But even with all of that, they not only expect a terrific rally tonight, but they also expect counter-protesters there as well.
Well, what has the league said about this? I mean, sports leagues, professional sports leagues in general, stay far away from political controversies. Even announcers who call games just don't touch things if they get a little bit warm. Planned Parenthood is hot. What does the league say?
Yeah, the league has basically said, my name is Paul and that's between y'all. In other words, they say Seattle is its own independent operation and they make these decisions and the league tries not to bigfoot the decisions made by individual clubs. They're practically taking a states' rights issue on Seattle doing this. And it's also certainly true that even though no other team has ever done anything like this, where they're openly taking on a political issue, it is true that teams have for the longest time in the WNBA attempted to market in ways that are very different from men's clubs. Like for years, long before it was of a fashion, if you will, the WNBA was doing pride nights, they were doing parties at LGBT bars. They were trying to market their league in a way different from the typical.
But Dave, there was political action in the WNBA last year. Some players came on television or on the court wearing Black Lives Matter shirts. There were fines initially. Those fines were rescinded. Has the league learned a lesson or decided specifically to do something differently?
Yes, and I think there are organic connections, both in terms of what the players involved in the Planned Parenthood protests are saying right now. And, of course, that some of the same players took part in those Black Lives Matter protests that are taking part in this particular protest as well. And I think the lesson that the league learned is that when it comes to the WNBA's very particular audience, they like the fact that the players have something to say about the world, and they don't like the fact that there might be a double standard where NBA players are allowed to wear political T-shirts on the court, but then WNBA players were attempted to be censored very quickly. That was a very, very bad look for the WNBA itself. And I really do think that the line that they have drawn is a line that says, okay, we're going to put this on the individual teams to police these actions, and we're going to take a pretty far step away from it.
New political activism, not on the part of individual players, but entire pro sports teams in the WNBA. Dave Zirin, sports editor for The Nation, host of the Edge of Sports podcast. Thanks, Dave.
Thank you so much, Todd.
It's The Takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick. Teen pregnancy is way down in America. But teen pregnancy programs established under the Obama administration are now set to lose funding following a decision by Health and Human Services earlier this month. The Office of Adolescent Health confirmed that it will cut 2 years of funding for 81 programs and 5 groups that were set to receive grant money through the Teen Pregnancy Prevention Program all the way through 2020. Those cuts amount to more than $200 million, according to Reveal and the Center for Investigative Reporting. And there's evidence, though, that many of those programs are working. Lewin Rohrbach is Associate Professor of Preventive Medicine at the University of Southern California and co-director of Keeping It Real Together. That's a sexual health education program that will lose its funding in June of next year under these cuts. She says there are a lot of reasons why teen pregnancy has gone down.
The economy has changed over two decades, and there's been a greater emphasis on a lot of factors that keep kids in high school longer. There has been more awareness about the need to educate young people about the availability of contraception. So, you know, these are examples of social factors that have contributed to the decline.
How much do we know about what works with teens?
We know quite a bit about what works. There have been several really good studies that have taken a look at the results of abstinence-only education. And what those so-called meta-evaluations have shown is that an abstinence-only approach is not effective in terms of changing young people's behavior. We also have quite a bit of research that has evaluated comprehensive sexual education approaches. And there are programs available now that are evidence-based, that the research has shown are effective in reducing sexual behavior and delaying the onset of sexual behavior.
So your program at USC, we mentioned, is called Keeping It Real Together. How does it work?
These federal funds enable us to support the delivery of comprehensive sexual health programs in local schools, and these are evidence-based programs. So we provide training to teachers in local schools, and the grant provides funds for materials, and then they deliver the programs in middle schools. As well, we are providing a parent education program, and this is, you know, somewhat unique among these grants. We reach parents of middle school youth, and we are delivering an evidence-based program that teaches them how to talk to their young person, or their young daughter or son, about sex and about the importance of delaying sex until they're older.
Professor, what will it mean to this program to get its federal funding cut? Can you get through with other sources of funding?
It will have a strong impact on us. We will attempt to get other funding for what we do, but it's a dramatic cut, and it will be challenging. Honestly, it will be challenging to find, you know, enough sources to keep the program going at the scale that we are currently working.
Lewin Rohrbach, thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Lewin Rohrbach is Associate Professor of Preventive Medicine at the University of Southern California. We reached out to the Department of Health and Human Services for a comment on the changes in funding. We did not get a response. Welcome back to The Takeaway. It's Todd Zwillick with you today. Our regular series, Case in Point, looks at controversial legal issues and how they impact real people. This week's Case in Point examines a nuanced piece of legal doctrine called qualified immunity. It's a concept intended to protect public employees from civil litigation. Here's Jennifer Lauren. She's a professor at the University of Texas Law School.
In some instances, even if a court finds that those officials did actually violate an individual's constitutional rights, they might still not be subject to suit or have to make payment to that individual because the law sort of protects what the doctrine says are reasonable missteps by public officials.
Now, qualified immunity is at the heart of a federal civil rights case filed in U.S. District Court in Lubbock, Texas, brought by Esmeralda Rivera back in 2015. In December of the year before, Rivera and her husband were arrested for public intoxication and driving under the influence. They were brought to the Hale County Jail in Texas, but it was there in a meeting room, not under video surveillance, that Ms. Rivera was sexually assaulted by Manuel Fierros, the officer in charge that night. Fierros pleaded guilty in the criminal case and received 3 years probation. Andrew Cohen is senior editor at the Marshall Project and author of Case in Point. He says, though, that despite the guilty plea and all the evidence in the civil rights case, a verdict in Ms. Rivera's favor still isn't likely.
She makes the claim. She says there are a bunch of reasons to justify it. The jail knew or should have known that this man, this guard, had problems. When he was 15, he had been arrested twice for some sort of sexually related crime, never convicted, never tried of that. And then there was an assault or some sort of sexual offense in the jail just a few months before the encounter with Ms. Rivera, where not much was done afterward. There wasn't a whole lot of additional training given to the guards. There wasn't additional video surveillance put into the jail. All of those things, she said to the courts in Texas, should have allowed her at least to get her case to a jury. That didn't happen. Both a federal trial judge in Lubbock, Texas, and then just a couple of weeks ago, the Fifth Circuit, the Federal Appeals Court for Texas, denied her relief, said that even though those supervisors of this guard probably should have done better, could have done better, they weren't so reckless, they weren't so indifferent to her needs that they should have to pay.
And why? Why did they say that in this case in a jail?
They said that because there had been at least one additional sign put up after the initial sexual conduct that took place with another inmate and another guard in July of 2014. They also said that the supervisors didn't really have a duty to investigate the evidence that this guard, Manuel Fierros, had some sort of sexual criminal conduct that at least generated an arrest. The court said, yes, they were aware of it, but there was no record. They called the prosecutor to find out what had happened. But what the record shows us is that these supervisors didn't even ask the job candidate, hey, listen, you're about to get a job in a jail. You're going to have some interaction with female detainees, with female inmates, with female prisoners. Tell us more about what you did at age 15 to generate two arrests for some sort of sexually related crime. The fact that they didn't answer that question, the court said, even that wasn't enough to generate liability for them and generate some sort of payment for Rivera.
Professor Jennifer Lauren, Andrew points out in the history of this case and in his article that there's a different legal standard and a different legal principle because this assault took place in a public jail versus a private office building somewhere. What's the difference?
The important difference is that the law provides that when a plaintiff like Ms. Rivera is suing a public official, as opposed to a private official or entity like a business or a McDonald's, that those public officials are entitled to essentially an additional level of immunity, as the law calls it. And this is different from private individuals. It is sometimes, I think, surprising to people who are not familiar with this area of law that the scope of liability when government actors overstep the law's boundaries and violate our constitutional rights is actually narrower than if your ordinary neighbor or employer does it. But that is the doctrine that exists.
It's understandable if a doctrine said a prison guard who clinks the handcuffs too tightly in the normal course of handcuffing and injures somebody's wrist. You can't sue them for damages. Look, putting handcuffs on can be risky behavior. Sometimes in the course of their duties, this is going to happen. We're not talking about that. We're talking about sexual assault.
I completely take the point of your sort of pushback on the extent to which application of the doctrine in a case like this seems to stray pretty far from the initial rationale behind the doctrine. One thing that I think should be made clear about the decision in the case, as Andrew described it, is that the Court of Appeals decision was limited to discussing liability of essentially the sort of supervisors and policymakers in the case, and didn't concern itself with the civil liability that the individual officer in the case might have.
So if you had a different standard that would apply in the law for qualified immunity, after that July 2014 episode, a reasonable supervisor might say, you know what, we have a problem here. The guards don't get it. This should have been an easy call for this guard to immediately call for backup, to immediately stop what was happening. Clearly, we need more training. Clearly, we need more video. Clearly, we need more signs and so forth. That didn't happen. The reason it doesn't happen is because the incentive for these supervisors to actually aggressively root out sexual assault in jail just doesn't exist. They know that right now the Supreme Court and the courts of Texas and the federal appeals courts that govern the law there have gone so broadly in favor of immunity, have extended immunity to such extents that they're not really going to get in trouble if they not just make mistakes, not just act negligently, but act recklessly. And so you have perverse incentives now set up to not protect people inside these prisons. And to make matters worse, I would argue, and I bet the professor would agree, when these courts do end up making decisions that protect supervisors like this, the courts don't say, by the way, this is really wrong, and if you want to protect people in the future, you need to do A, B, C, and D. The courts don't take that extra step. They sort of leave it ambiguous and amorphous, which I think generates additional litigation down the road because there's not the kind of clarity you need to ensure that the rights of people are protected.
One case from a Texas jail highlights immunity enjoyed by supervisors and prison guards across the country. Andrew Cohen, senior editor at the Marshall Project and author of Case in Point. Thank you, Andrew.
My pleasure.
And Jennifer Lauren, thanks to you.
Thanks very much.
Jennifer Lauren is professor at the University of Texas Law School.
From the earliest moments of our acquaintance, I have come to feel for you a passionate admiration and regard, which, despite all my struggles, has overcome every rational objection, and I beg you most fervently to relieve my suffering and consent to be my wife.
In such cases as these, I believe the established mode is to express a sense of obligation, but I cannot.
Do you recognize that conversation? Fans of Pride and Prejudice know right away that's Mr. Darcy fighting to win the heart and the hand of Elizabeth Bennet. And those fans love Jane Austen's world of keen observation and sharp wit, all set in a backdrop of 19th century England.
It is a truth universally acknowledged that a single man in possession of a good fortune must be in want of a wife.
Men of sense, whatever you may say, do not want silly wives.
Mama, the more I know of the world, the more I am convinced that I shall never see a man whom I can really love. I require so much.
Jane Austen produced just 6 novels in her career, but her stories of social class, marriage, feminism, and yes, women in love have left a huge mark on literature and pop culture. Sense and Sensibility was first in 1811, followed just 2 years later by Pride and Prejudice, and then Mansfield Park, and then Emma. Jane Austen's witty banter and razor-sharp observation was a hit in England first, and then in America, and of course today. It's popular beyond even what she could have dreamed of. Jane Austen had a short career, though. She died at just 41 years old, 200 years ago today. And that anniversary means a celebration and an appreciation for Jane Austen fans and scholars. Part of that celebration takes place near the yellow-painted brick home where Austen lived in Winchester, England. And Juliet Wells is there now. She's professor of English at Goucher College, also author of Everybody's Jane Austen in the Popular Imagination. And her forthcoming book is called Reading Austen in America. Juliet, welcome.
Thank you.
Well, what's being celebrated today, do you think? You know, not every author gets a party 2 centuries after her death.
Oh, it's absolutely true, but nobody deserves it more than Jane Austen. It's hard to imagine a novelist from her time period who has more devoted fans and readers around the globe.
So why is that? Let's stick to America. What is it that Americans love so much about her, do you think? We do have a fascination with British things, that's true. We love period pieces, that's also true, but it's more than that.
It is more than that. I think Americans respond to the sense of freedom within constraints that she portrays, especially for her women characters. And of all her novels, Pride and Prejudice is the one that has a sentiment that I think Americans respond to most strongly.
Tell me why, Pride and Prejudice, why that one?
Elizabeth Bennet, the heroine, speaks truth to power. She doesn't take any guff from Lady Catherine de Bourgh, the titled woman who is her social superior, but not in any way her superior in other senses. And Pride and Prejudice also emphasizes the importance of pursuing your own version of personal happiness. And I think Americans respond very strongly to that.
This idea of freedom within constraint is interesting to me because, you know, at first glance, you might think, well, Jane Austen stories, they're a bit antiquated. The quest for a husband, there's lots of witty repartee, and there's certainly a lot of interesting psychology in these books. But some of this is a bit passé for modern American women. But you say there's still a lot of freedom within that.
You know, I hear from readers all the time, readers of all ages and all backgrounds, that they find Jane Austen's depiction of human nature just absolutely incomparable. And I hear from women readers and young women in particular that they find not just Austen's heroines, but Austen's own life story very inspirational because she chose not to marry in a time period when marriage was the accepted fate for women. She chose to concentrate on her writing. She devoted herself with incredible professionalism to writing in what turned out to be the last decade of her life. She didn't see any of her works published until she was in her 30s, but she had been writing steadily, more or less, as circumstances permitted since her early teens. So for anyone who wants to have a life as an artist or as a writer, she's a very inspirational example.
Jane Austen wrote anonymously. The six novels she's most famous for came out anonymously, not by Jane Austen as they're known today. That's sort of ironic for an author whose work has become so intensely popular today.
You're absolutely right. Her first publication gave her identity on the title page only as By a Lady, and that was the novel Sense and Sensibility in 1811. And then after that, each title page identified her as the author of Sense and Sensibility or the author of Pride and Prejudice.
Man, I mean, times have changed, haven't they? I hear you say that, and I just think it's remarkable, especially given the themes and the dilemmas that her characters had.
Yes, and she focuses so much on women's growth in self-knowledge, women's growth emotionally and psychologically. And readers for generations have gotten the sense that nothing held Jane Austen back in spite of all the constraints that are evident even on those title pages.
So now today, Juliet, millions of Americans read the books, but millions more, of course, go to the movies. We know that. Huge stars have taken a crack at Jane Austen characters. We've moved on to these meta adaptations, Pride and Prejudice and Zombies.
Her face is rendered uncommonly intelligent by the beautiful expression of her dark eyes.
And, you know, I had no idea until yesterday that Clueless was Emma. I just never knew that. I've read Emma, I've seen Clueless. I had no idea they were the same thing.
Everything I think and everything I do is wrong. I was wrong about Elton. I was wrong about Christian. Now Josh hated me. It all boiled down to one inevitable conclusion. I was just totally clueless.
I'm so glad to hear you say that because my students tell me that all the time. So certainly, there's no question, the wonderful films of the 1990s and the beginning of the 2000s have built audiences for Austen in a way that nothing else could have done. But there can be a challenge sometimes if you feel that you've gotten to know Austen through the films and you've had actors and screenwriters and directors and costume designers and location managers and everyone helping make a beautiful story for you. There can be a challenge when you open an Austen novel and it really is all on you and you realize, hey, her sentences are quite long and her paragraphs also quite long and things don't move as quickly. So I think there's still a gap to be bridged when lovers of the films make their way to the novels.
There are a lot of people listening, before I let you go, who've always meant to read Jane Austen. They thought about it. They've seen the movies. Maybe in private, they know they've never actually picked up one of the novels. So what's your advice? Where to start?
I would recommend Pride and Prejudice for most people. But Persuasion, which is her story about an older heroine, a 27-year-old heroine, is a lovely one if you happen to be past the first blush of youth yourself. If you like humor best, then perhaps Northanger Abbey would be the place to start, since that's the novel where her humor is most broad.
keen advice from Juliet Wells on the 200th anniversary of the death of Jane Austen. Juliet Wells is author of the forthcoming book, Reading Austen in America. Thanks for being with us.
Thanks, Todd. It was a pleasure.
Well, Jane Austen's novels were not made in America, but all this hour we've been talking about American manufacturing, and you've been weighing in about buying American.
This is Michelle from Hawaii. I prefer to buy made in the USA when I can. However, we live in a global economy and are so interconnected that it is difficult to find made in America products. And while I would like to support that effort, and more specifically made in Hawaii, it's not always easy or affordable.
And here's a tweet we got from Beverly. She says, during a recent kitchen remodel, I committed to choosing ethically sourced green products from our hemisphere. It was challenging. You got to stick up for your hemisphere, right? Give us your take at 8778-MY-TAKE. You can always tweet us at The Takeaway. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Todd Zwillick, in for John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
PRI, Public Radio International.
There's a lot going on right now. Mounting economic inequality, threats to democracy, environmental disaster, the sour stench of chaos in the air. I'm Brooke Gladstone, host of WNYC's On the Media. Want to understand the reasons and the meanings of the narratives that led us here, and maybe how to head them off at the pass? That's On the Media's specialty. Take a listen wherever you get your podcasts.